Après quelques petits préparatifs techniques qui sont dus à la nature de notre première intervention de l'après-midi, qui est assez particulière, nous allons donc écouter Catalina Vincens, de l'Université de Leiden, qui est donc à la fois musicologue et musicienne, hein, qui a étudié le clavecin et qui a étudié ensuite les théories musicales au XIIe et XIIIe siècle. Et je crois qu'on va avoir une performance issue de ces deux compétences. Donc nous vous laissons la parole avec plaisir.
Je vais commencer par la musique alors. Je commence par dire merci, merci pour cette belle invitation de... Ah, je parle en anglais. thank you for this great invitation and it's a pleasure to be surrounded by so many interesting people. And I have to admit in the first place, philosophy is not my field. But it's a great chance to be here and hopefully to start establishing a dialogue that has been there between music, musicology, and the research of medieval polyphony, medieval music, and philosophy. Things that were intrinsically connected in many levels, I think, but that because of our separation of disciplines, of course, sometimes this communication, this dialogue that used to happen back then in the 12th and 13th century needs some bridges to be rebuilt, so to say. So I apologize if there are any terms or any notions that could be perhaps far from what you people dedicated to philosophy have dedicated your lives to. But I hope it opens some questions. One of the most important sources of the late 12th century polyphony, the Magnus Liber Organi, opens with an illustration that is going to serve as the music philosophical fundament for generations. Poethis de musica. In a three-story building, a woman with a crown is depicted in each level, indicating with a hand to the scenes opposite to her. In the uppermost level, her, the allegorical figure of music, of musica, points reverently towards an earthly sphere. She represents musica mundana, or the music of the spheres, the concept of the divine proportions that brings order to nature. In the bottom, musica warns with a finger to a man holding a fiddle in the opposite chamber. She is musica instrumentalis, the music made mechanically by men, that is the music that we understand as music, but made by instruments, but also by voices. In here, it is a reflection of the divine order of the music of the spheres on the planet Earth. In the middle, musica brings her hand up in a gesture, intervening or dialoguing with four people in the opposite chamber. They holding hands represent the effect of music in people, musica humana, or the music created between the souls of human beings. Mirroring Pythagoras, Boethius had suggested that God created the world through numbers, and it is thus music formed by arithmetic proportions what can mirror the divine on earth, and therefore the human soul is composed in itself by musical proportions. This vision of a fluid dialogue between microcosmos and macrocosmos is going to be one of the instruments of what I will call the musical philosophy throughout the Middle Ages. Once we turn the page of this same codex, the Magnus Liber, an illuminated capital introduces a picture of musical symbols. Four lines, four voices, and four people are represented in this page. Continuum filled with dissonance and consonance, each poet relates to the fundament, the tenor, which, supporting the perfect three voices lying ornately above, provides orally and visually a point of reference. At the same time, each one of the voices above serves as a mirror to the others, a seemingly never-ending ecstatic song, a sempiternal whirling dance of empathy, in this instance celebrating the birth of Christ in what became one of the most extensive and iconic medieval pieces known to us today. Viderunt omnes finis terre, salutare Dei nostri, jubilate Deo omnis terre. Perotinus, a young monk in Paris, used the compositions of his master Leonin as a basis to create this Organum Quadruplum, a language that was unheard, or better said, unseen before. Technically, the organum is to compose or improvise a new melody, so-called vox organalis, to the principal pre-existing melody, or vox principalis, which is the one of the tenor that I just mentioned. This technique is already described in an anonymous source from the northeastern France around the year 1860, called Musica Enchiriadis. By the late 12th century, this early polyphonic technique had reached its peak of complexity in terms of structure, rhythm, mode, thanks to the development of musical notation. In the 12th century, musical notation also achieved a level of accuracy and efficacy unprecedented in history. Neither the Greek nor the Arabic and Eastern Oriental cultures had developed a system of codification of sound that could compare to what was being developed in Northern Europe. Notation had developed from the 9th to 11th centuries and used space synoptically to indicate the height of pitch according to the Greek modes, or tonoi, although it's still used a somewhat rudimentary way to represent time or sound duration. On one hand, notation served practically in the attempt to standardize the musical rituals of the church and to accelerate the learning process of it. On the other, notation was a way to translate the organized, yet ephemeral, divine proportions into a concrete language which could be heard and observed, replicated and recreated. I propose that this process of translation was a pivotal catalyst for the further development of a new realm of musical commentaries and ideas, which I'm going to explore later in this presentation. A similar effect to the process of translation that experienced the Arabic and the Arabic world and Europe during this period. In music, the language that was being translated into visual signs was in fact a language that during the 12th century was not exclusive to Europe, but which was shared among Mediterranean cultures. During the 9th to 10th century, Muslim musicians consciously exchanged styles with Christians, as was the case of Sulaym, who learned music from Christians from the north, then from a slave singer in Baghdad, and combined the two, creating a new style. This is one of the many documented musicians who were allowed and encouraged to do this exchange. By the 13th century, in the courts of Christian Spain, musicians from Moorish Spain and Sephardis collaborated closely, something that is particularly well documented in the Cantigas de Santa Maria, written during the reign of Alfonso X el Sabio. For this process of communication to be possible, there must have been a source of musical intelligibility, as Reynolds suggests. Back in the 10th century, written music was not established among the traditions, so it could not have been served to communicate among different cultures. It is then modality in itself which must have served as the common language, a bridge between regional traditions, where everyone, despite using individual music dialects, could communicate and influence each other. It is through the mathematical Pythagorean division expressed in sound, exemplified by Boethius with the division of the string of a monochord, that we see exemplified there, and the comparing of the sounds of bells and proportionals of proportional sizes, that the tones that conform each mode are attained. An entire sequence of tones generated by subdivision is what we understand as mode or modus of a scale. Or today we would call that similarly a scale. Paradoxically, it is the modal polyphony developed from the 12th century onwards what is soon going to become a crucial factor in the division of musical worlds, East and West. Christianity would, on one hand, use the status of notated music to develop the ever more complex system of polyphony, relying on a relatively simple and stable modal or tonal system. On the contrary, the Arabic world will develop modality using complex systems of microtones and expanding modes, a phenomenon that could only be attained through oral traditions. It was Boethius himself, as we saw in the depiction of Musica Humana, who observed that music in itself was able to resolve dissonance or discord between people. Before I discuss the possible relation to the concept of harmonia and dissonancia with musical harmony and dissonance, let's take a look at how the Pythagorean system of tones and modes works and what does musical dissonance mean for 12th century ears, which is not what we understand necessarily today as dissonance. So here, almost in the manner of a children's book of learning music with colors, this is one of the main modes that we have, that is, each mode is defined by its finalis, which in this case is going to be D. Then we have the perfect consonances, fifth and octave. Another consonance, the fourth, which by the 12th century is used more as an unstable consonant. And then we have different types of dissonances. Now let's apply this concept to one of the commentaries or the Organum Procella written by Philip the Chancellor from the Organum that you just heard at the beginning. What the French poet did in this instance is to take two voices of Perrotin's Organum and close them literally, writing a poetic text to the pre-existing material. This voice. Chancellor does not only take the poetic rhythm, which develops together with the melodic variation, but if we look at the text setting that unfortunately is not very well visible here, in relation to the vox principalis, we're going to be surprised. Knowing already some basic principles of harmonic dissonance in Pythagorean tuning, which is going to be a crucial factor for this modal system and dissonance to work, let's look at the first section of Vite Prophetia. I'm going to be playing, this is supposed to be sung, so we're missing parts, a great and important part of this whole concept. What we are underlining though is the dissonance and what is there in the music composition itself and how they use that for setting this new glossing of the text. So just to reintroduce what we were seeing before, I will show what this tones of the scale or the modus would sound like. We had started from a re. The consonant, the main consonant, is a fifth. And an eighth, or octave. Now, another consonant in Pythagorean tuning is the fourth. To go to the fifth. Then we have the second. In Pythagorean tuning, strong dissonance. The third that's also a dissonance. There's lots of oscillation acoustically in that interval compared to later tuning systems that are not based in Pythagoras directly. Then from the fifth we have a sixth dissonance, seventh. You don't want to stay there, but here. As basic as this may seem to our modern ears that are so overwhelmed with sound, this was something that was being explored for the almost first time to an extent that was unprecedented before. So I'll start, if we could have less light so that the audience could look at what is on the screen, that would be wonderful. I will outline the dissonances. The Chancellor, by setting this text to a possibly pre-existing melody, although we don't really know the chronology of all of this, is setting, it's doing basically another translation and interpretation of the religious texts that he's composing at the same time. Here are the main consonances that you just heard. And then we have minor dissonances, strong dissonances that are emphasizing both the accentuation of the text, of each word syllabically, but also of the sentences, and creating longer melodic portions of dissonance or tension. In this prosula, Widerunt Omnes, we will find that the poet works closely in the text setting of the melody, almost as if it was conceived together with the composition of Perrotin at the end of the 12th century. Chancellor does not only take the poetic rhythm, which develops together with the melodic variation, but if we look at the text setting in relation to the Vox Principalis, we are going to be surprised. Knowing already some basic principles of harmony, of harmonic dissonance in Pythagorean tuning, let's look at that, which is the preparation of dissonances. Then I think I'm not going to have time to go through the other section. There's a second text set by Chancellor as a response. It's a literary response to the same commentary that he already did. The second text, Homo cum mandato, with a different rhetorical meaning, was composed to the subsequent section of the same Organum Viderum Omnes by Perotinus. A further extension of this type of commentary can be seen in this Conductus Clausula, where Chancellor takes an existing conductus, another contemporary music form, where different views on the same subject are juxtaposed. Here, this was originally just music, or we think so, and then these different texts are juxtaposed, so we have different visions at the same time. Both Chancellor and Perrotin are applying the principles of the scholastic method to music, composition, division, and subdivision. In this example, each voice is set syllabically to a new text, where each melody and text relates to the tenor, which is now also rhythmicized and set syllabically. I'm going just to briefly show what I'm talking about in this anima conductus prosulia. I'll start by playing just the tenor, or tenor is the word for the fundament or the basic structural note. If we can have less light, c'est possible d'avoir la
un peu moins de lumière. Est-ce qu'on peut baisser un peu la lumière, s'il vous plaît? Merci.
Merci. So the tenor. Finalis D, we're going to do the same oral exercise, but with this Bourdon note, just to hear what the dissonances are. Resolution. Now, the next voice up, the motetus, which says, what flesh are you, subject to a spirit? Are you steamed by some feeble fart? With the tenor, anima iuge lacrima, di fluer. This is just a very short example of how this tension and the concept of dissonance of two different or three different messages is being used. In the late 12th century, the process of juxtaposing different views, as in the musical works of Perutinus and Philip the Chancellor, both synoptically and conceptually, brings us closer to the newer philosophical approaches being cultivated by their contemporaries. Although it is not possible to quantify the influence of any philosophy in music, even if Boethius is the apparent authority, we cannot exclude the influence of the Muslim world, nor can we isolate this speculative art in itself from the contemporary thought. The unprecedented complex language which was developed during the 12th century Renaissance, the confronting of dissenting musical views through the resolving of dissonance in harmonia, will be a way to search and achieve truth. Thus, we can understand that the act of making music at least I propose here, combined with the studying and creating of it, is an act of philosophizing in itself. It is through the observation, the translation, its further commentary, that music will serve as a tool to understand the world. Music becomes the instrument in itself in the search of a path to truth. Thank you.